A pretty busy show for you on Connecticut Today on Wednesday, the 7th of October. We got into organized crime a bit in our number one, a new book out about the famed Murder Incorporated. You've heard a song about it. You may have seen the movie. But what are the origins of Murder Incorporated? We talked about that in our number one. Our number two, African-American conservative commentator Giano Caldwell called in to talk about his new podcast and his theory and thoughts on the upcoming election and the vice presidential debate. And in the 5 o'clock hour, Quinnipiac University political science professor Dr. Wes Renfro also gave us his thoughts and a preview on the vice presidential debate. Our next guest is a prolific author. He has written several books. He was also an editor at the New York Times for 7 years. He's written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Sports Illustrated, many other publications, lives in New York City. So once again, we welcome another guest to the show who has a far better resume than I will ever have. But hey, that's why I'm here. Michael Cannell is the guest. Michael, hi. Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here with you.
I love to talk to people who have great resumes that I'll never aspire to, but this is great stuff, Michael. Thank you. The name of the book, A Brotherhood Betrayed, The Man Behind the Rise and Fall of Murder Incorporated. Now, anybody, Michael, who lives in the Northeast, who grew up in the Northeast, New York, New Jersey, even Connecticut, Fairfield County, Milford, New Haven, Bridgeport, everybody kind of knew about the mob, right, from the 30s into the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But you concentrate, I guess, on a, I don't know, subcontractors or a branch of the mob that everybody kind of heard about. There was a movie in 1960. There's a Bruce Springsteen song about these guys. Who were or what was Michael Murder Incorporated?
Yeah, well, let me explain it this way. We during Prohibition, the mob made money without even trying. I mean, when the beer taps shut off during Prohibition, the mob controlled bootlegging. They controlled the speakeasies. They controlled prostitution. They controlled gambling. They controlled the rum running. So the mob had made tons of money, piles and piles of money, without even really trying. And when Prohibition ended, a next generation of mobsters took over, and they wanted to run things differently. They wanted to run the mob like an American corporation. They wanted to run it almost like McDonald's with franchises all over the country. And part of their plan was to have an assassination squad, which came to be known as Murder Incorporated. And Murder Incorporated's job was to eliminate anybody who could be an informant, anybody who could testify against them in court. Their theory was, if there are no informants, there isn't going to be any prosecution. And that plan worked for about a decade. And then, you know, it worked until it didn't work. And then things really went bad.
And this was an amalgamation, as you point out here and as other sources say, Michael. These were Italian-American mobsters and Jewish mobsters, too, together with some very familiar names. I mean, a lot of people have probably heard of people like Albert Anastasia, other famous mobsters. But there's one person you focus on in here, Abe Relis. Talk about all that.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably name off the top of our head a half a dozen or a dozen mobsters who are almost like household names, right? But yeah. Abe Relis is not one of them. He was just a kind of like a tier or two down in the mob hierarchy from the famous mobsters like Lucky Luciano or Bugsy Siegel. He was a tough kid from Brooklyn, a Jewish kid who punched his way to the top of the crime hierarchy in Brooklyn. And he overthrew the local mob bosses there in part by teaming up with Italian mobsters. And so he formed his own mob, which he called the Combination, because it was half Jewish, half Italian. And they were the ones who served as Murder Incorporated.
Was it a testy alliance? Was it one of these things where they all had territories carved out here? Hey, you have your blocks, we have ours, everybody makes money, and nobody steps on anybody's toes. Was that how it was back then?
Well, I mean, everybody back then had their own territory. Everybody had a specialty. You were either a loan shark, or you were involved in prostitution, or you know, you were involved in stealing cars. Everybody had their own specialty and their own turf. But you have to remember, these were guys who had grown up together. They'd grown up in the same neighborhoods, pretty much, the Lower East Side of Manhattan and Brooklyn. And they'd gone to the same schools. They dated the same girls. They hung out in the same pool halls. So, you know,
so it was a lifestyle. So it was a lifestyle for them.
It was a lifestyle. I don't think they used the term lifestyle, but we can. They were all pretty much alienated from the way their parents lived, be they Italian or Jewish. They all wanted to be successful, wealthy Americans, and for them, what that meant was making money through the mob.
The name of the book will continue here in a moment. A Brotherhood Betrayed, The Man Behind the Rise and Fall of Murder Incorporated. Best-selling author Michael Cannell is the guest. Michael, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Hang tight. Traffic and weather together, 2:36 on a Wednesday on WICC. Murder Incorporated. We've all heard about it, dating back to the mobsters of the 30s and 40s, the Italian mobsters, the Irish-American mobsters, Murder Incorporated, the hit squad there. This all took place not too far from where we are. Author Michael Cannell is the guest. A few more minutes with him. A Brotherhood Betrayed, The Man Behind the Rise and Fall of Murder Incorporated. Boy, Michael, in researching this and reading parts of your book, they kill people just about any conceivable way you could. It was not delicate. It was not clean many times. And then all of a sudden, this guy, Abe Reles, like you say, who was kind of a second-tier guy, he flips and he says, essentially, well, I got info if you guys want it. Talk about all that.
Yeah, I mean, he was responsible for the deaths of hundreds and hundreds of people. Nobody has an exact number because, of course, the mob didn't keep track of these things. They didn't put it down in writing. It has been estimated that they killed 1,000 people. That seems a little hard to believe, but hundreds and hundreds anyway. So Abe Reles spent his entire adult life killing informants. And then very abruptly, he became an informant himself. Mm. And he did that to avoid prosecution. He was in jail. The police had implicated him in a murder. They had implicated some of his associates. The police put them in separate jails so that they couldn't communicate with each other. And they each became kind of paranoid. They were afraid that somebody else was making a deal with the police. Mm-hmm. And the police kind of shrewdly played them off of each other. And none of them wanted to be the one who was left out. It was almost like musical chairs. And so Abe Reles made a deal with the police, and he decided that he was going to tell them about the details of these hundreds of murders.
Now, in doing that, and I know from interviewing folks over the years who've dealt with the mob, I mean, Michael, you and I know that once you do that, you become a rat. That didn't seem to bother him?
Well, it probably bothered him a great deal, but he was trying to save his own life and trying to protect his family. The Witness Protection Program did not yet exist, but in agreeing to cooperate, he essentially arranged for his own Witness Protection Program. Mm-hmm. The district attorney agreed to protect him and his family. So, I mean, I think, you know, he has in discussing this or explaining this, he has said that he did what he had to do. Any of these other guys would do what they had to do. You know, in the mafia, there is this a lot of talk about what they call omerta, the code of honor, the, you know, nobody is supposed to talk, but a lot of them did when push came to shove.
Now, he didn't live too long. He passed away. His body was found, what, early November of 41. Michael, was he trying to climb out of a jail window, or was he pushed out? Was this an unfortunate quote unquote accident here, in the Half Moon Hotel? Yeah.
Yeah. This is the great mystery. This is one of the great enduring mysteries of mob history. On the morning that he was to have testified against one of the big mob lords, he went out the window of his hotel room and died. The police called it an escape. Was he trying to escape? I mean, there is some reason to believe that he might be trying to escape. He had stashed $60,000 then, a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
A lot of money then, a lot of money now, but really a lot of money then. And there is some reason to believe that he may have been trying to retrieve that money and deliver it to his wife, to his family. Mm-hmm. Most people would say the last thing that Abrelles wanted to do was leave that hotel, because as long as he was in that hotel, he was under police protection. Most people would say somebody threw him out the window. The question mm-hmm. then is, who threw him out? Did the mob pay the police to look the other way? Mm. Did the mob pay the police to throw him? It would not be far-fetched for the police themselves to have thrown him out the window, because when Abrelles testified, remember, he was going to talk about all of the policemen and city officials who had routinely taken bribes from the mob. So there is some indication that William O'Dwyer, then the district attorney, later mayor of New York, may have known about this plan or even have been involved in this plan.
Wow.
I say that in part because when questions about this came up later, when William O'Dwyer was mayor of New York, he very abruptly quit his job as mayor and became ambassador to Mexico, safely beyond the reach of any questions.
So you go from Manhattan to across the border in Mexico.
Yeah.
There you go. The mob still, Michael, whether it's books like yours, whether it's the Sopranos series, whether it's the Scorsese movies like, you know, Casino and Goodfellas and things like this, or the TV series, The Untouchables, all that. Boy, we really do have, I hate to say it, but it's almost a soft spot, a fascination for these guys. Michael, what do you attribute that to?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I have thought about this a lot, and I wish I had a really complete answer for you. I mean, the best thing I can say is that I think that these mob stories are a little bit like Shakespeare. You know, we each generation makes a great mob movie, whether it's The Godfather or Goodfellas or The mm-hmm. Irishman. It seems to hold, as you say, it seems to hold endless fascination for us. And we draw out of it these stories about brotherhood and betrayal and love and loss. It seems to be, it seems to go on and on. And you know, our children and their children will probably also be telling these stories about mobs.
I have always thought, Michael, that part of the fascination is whether it's The Godfather or Casino or Goodfellas or especially The Sopranos. I think America looks at that and they say, God, these guys are ruthless, bloodthirsty. They'll kill their own brother in the mob if they have to. But, you know, they still donate money to the church and they still go home and get yelled at because the refrigerator's empty. There's kind of this weird juxtaposition that, yeah, they're bloodthirsty, but they get henpecked like I do. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, one of the really great books written back in the 30s about the Jewish mobsters was entitled "But He Was Nice to His Mother." So there is that there is this way in which by day they were absolutely ruthless killers, and but at the same time at night they could come home and have dinner with their families, and they were really really like middle class Americans.
Yeah. And I think they would say,
really,
hey.
when we talk about the mob, it is really kind of an American story, because what they wanted, these were immigrants or the children of immigrants, and all they really wanted was to get ahead in America.
And to them, they would always say, hey, it's just business. That's it. No, no offense. It's just business. Name of the book is A Brotherhood Betrayed, The Man Behind the Rise and Fall of Murder Incorporated. So if you've always heard that phrase, folks, or you've seen the 1960 movie, or you've heard the Bruce Springsteen song, this is what it's based on. Michael Kennel is the guest. Michael, good luck with this, and thank you so much. It's getting rave reviews, and hopefully we can speak in the future. Thanks.
I'd love that. Yeah, thank you very much.
Appreciate it, Michael. Thanks. Michael Kennel, C-A-N-N-E-L-L. Right now you see him a lot. He's a Fox News political analyst. He also has a new podcast, Out Loud, it's called. A gentleman joining us right now, Giano Caldwell, is on the phone. Giano, a very prominent African-American member of the Republican Party, the conservative movement. We'll talk with him about some current events, the election coming up and all that. Giano, Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing quite well. New podcast, Out Loud with Giano Caldwell, where we're the sworn enemy of PC culture. So super excited to talk about that, as well as the big news of the day. Did you know there's a debate going on today? Did you realize that?
Yeah, Giano. Well, first of all, Giano, tell us a little bit about the podcast here. I know, and you know, we podcast all our shows. That's the best thing. Now, if people go to download Out Loud with Giano Caldwell, what are they going to hear?
Well, our first episode is with Herschel Walker, which we talk a lot about faith. We talk about moving the country forward. We talk about how he's been as a celebrated NFL legend since he's come out and said that he supports Trump. And he says that President Trump isn't racist. He also mentions some things that are some surprises that you want to listen to, point blank period. So it's Out Loud with Giano Caldwell. Well, we're the sworn enemy of PC culture. You can get it anywhere with podcasts. You have your podcast, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio app, wherever you get your podcasts.
How did we, before we get to the debate tonight, Giano, how did we get entrapped into this PC culture where if you just express an opinion that is not of the main of what the mob wants you to think, you get chastised, you get yelled at, you get destroyed on social media. How the heck did we get here?
You know what? I'm going to be honest with you. I think the real uprising to the PC culture happened under 8 years of the Obama administration. It came to the degree that if you said anything that the left didn't like, just like you said, or the media, you were considered to be a racist, sexist. Anything that we can normally have a conversation about, like our politics, for example, one could say, hey, I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative, I support Donald Trump. One could say that, and it'd be all good, generally, back in those days. Now, they consider you a basket of deplorables if you support Donald Trump. They consider you all kind of negative names if you support Donald Trump. And the interesting part about it is, we don't really hear those kind of things being yelled to the other side. You don't hear a lot of conservatives saying, oh, you support Joe Biden, therefore you must be a racist, or you must be a this or a that. We don't really live by those rules because we believe in freedom and the First Amendment, which is the ability to give free thought and say what you want, the freedom of speech, which is what the Constitution guaranteed us. The left have taken it in a completely and totally different direction that you can be canceled just for simply stating your opinion. And that's a problem in this country right now. That's why at Out Loud with Giano Caldwell, we're the sworn enemy of the PC culture.
You have, I would guess, Giano, being a black man, being an African-American man who is a conservative, have you been attacked with the, well, and excuse the phrases here, Uncle Tom, House Negro?
Yes.
Have you heard all of that? And how's that make you feel?
Listen, I was on air on Shannon Bream's show last night. I got off and I got a message on Instagram from somebody, and please follow me on social media, Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, at Giano Caldwell, G-I-A-N-N-O, Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L. And I got that nastiest message from some lady somewhere, which I posted on my Twitter. And it's insulting that people, especially within the African-American community, where we should believe in diversity of thought. We talk about diversity for everything else. We should believe in diversity of thought. We shouldn't coalesce around a particular political party, the Democratic Party, especially considering the fact that the Democratic Party is the one that really pushed racism and entrapping black folks. That's really the party. You think about the 94 crime bill under Joe Biden, millions of black people impacted. You think negatively impacted with jail sentences for doing things that some other folks kind of sort of got away with. You think about the 86 crack laws, which Joe Biden, again, was the sponsor of, providing tougher penalties for those who did crack cocaine over those who did powder coke, which we know that was racist legislation because it impacted African Americans at a higher degree versus another group of people. So this is what the Democratic Party has become, a party that's maybe looking for black votes. I say all the time that black votes don't matter, that black lives don't matter to Democrats, black votes do. But yet and still not providing policy that positively impacts the community. We should be looking for all Americans to be well taken care of. And I think that's what President Trump has looked to do day after day. And we've seen it through policy measure after policy measure, an economy that was roaring pre-COVID, unemployment, the lowest rates for African-Americans, Hispanics, and Asians, lowest on record for women, a 50-year low. This is a president who actually cared about all Americans, not just because you belong to a particular political party.
All right, Giano, hang on. We'll be right back with you. We'll talk about the debate coming up tonight. The podcast is Out Loud with Giano Caldwell, G-I-A-N-N-O-C-A-A-L-D-W-E-L-L. You see him on Fox News all the time. We have him right here for a few more minutes. Giano, hang on. Traffic and weather together on the sixes right here on WICC. And we spend a few more minutes with Giano Caldwell, Fox News political analyst, the new podcast Out Loud with Giano Caldwell. So, Giano, we have the debate tonight, Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris. I'm interested to see what goes down here, Giano, because something I've railed at on this show for weeks, Senator Harris, and I get especially upset with this, Giano, because I do have a journalism background as a base in this business. She simply has not done news conferences. She will not just right. talk to the press in a free-form fashion. And I'm wondering, well, what is she hiding here? Why are they hiding?
Well, what is Joe Biden hiding? Like, well, more importantly, he's the top of the ticket, although he said he's going to be a transitional candidate. I talk about this exclusively on FoxNews.com. If you look at my piece on the debate, it just came out today. Again, this is Giano Caldwell. Check out FoxNews.com for that piece, that opinion piece. But I'll tell you this. The debates, the vice presidential debate started in 1976. And typically it's a yawn fest. People don't really make a decision by way of the vice presidential debate. But Mike Pence, there's a lot on his shoulders tonight. And I'm going to be honest because I'm a truth teller. Last week, the debate was a train wreck, and that was for both candidates, not just Donald Trump. For everyone that tries to say that Donald Trump was him. No, it was Joe Biden, too. Joe Biden used a lot of names, called him a clown, called him all kinds of things. So it wasn't like Joe Biden was some presidential figure. That would be a lie. And he lied about his support of radical left proposals like the Green New Deal and his support for Senator Bernie Sanders on a number of initiatives. So we know what that is. Now, with Kamala Harris, she is the most radical left senator in the Senate today. She's the most radical left. And Mike Pence has a job to do. He has a job to, one, disseminate a strong message on how effective the Trump administration has been for America, talking about the economy. He's been ahead of the COVID-19 task force. He needs to talk about that and provide a contrast as to where we are now and where we could have been had they not taken some steps in terms of shutting down travel. A lot of things that Joe Biden said was racist. He said cutting off travel was racist. That's what the left said. If you remember, Nancy Pelosi went into Chinatown and said, hey, everyone come into Chinatown. This is a great place to be. Don't listen to the Trump administration. So that's going to be a main priority. And also showing what Kamala Harris' record has been and really connecting her to the fact that Joe Biden has said that he is a transitional figure, which means he's really setting the stage for Kamala Harris. So who's really running for president? Is it Joe Biden or is it Kamala Harris? And have you seen any one interview that Kamala Harris said, hey, this is the Harris administration. This is what the
Harris
administration
is going to
look like. So, I mean, we really don't know. So we don't know who Mike Pence is actually debating tonight. Is this the person who's running for president or the person running for vice president?
Look, I understand, Gianno, that she was a high-profile Senate member from a big blue state. I get that. But I was still a little surprised that Joe Biden picked her, because here's a person who stop just short, Gianno, in one or two of the debates of telling Mr. Biden or associating him with racists. And I said, wow, you talk about strange bedfellows. I mean, I guess everybody makes up, but I was shocked, and I wonder what the reflection of that will be when, you know, she in that first debate was doing stuff like, well, I don't think you're a racist, but wink, wink, wink.
Right.
Right.
Well, I tell you, there's a lot of people making money on racism, and I don't say that jokingly. There's a lot of people, especially in the Democratic Party, that have to continue to keep narratives alive in general. And I'm not saying racism doesn't exist; it absolutely does. But Joe Biden's policies have, in a lot of cases, been institutionally racist. So when she mentioned that, she was absolutely right. I mean, that's one thing I got to say. But in the Democratic Party, you know, if you're one of their races, it's all good. You can stay with them. Just ask the governor of Virginia right now. He'll tell you. I mean, so long as you're a Democrat racist, it's fine. It's all good. You see, when we've had folks on the right who said things that were racist or super inappropriate, something happens. They get stripped of their committee assignments. They get pushed out of the party. We've seen that time and time again. It doesn't necessarily happen in the Democratic Party, though, which is awful.
Finally, Gianno, give me your thoughts on the president doing a little bit better, depending upon the poll you look at, than normal with both Hispanic and African-American voters, particularly black men. And even a couple of polls I saw a few days ago, despite the fact that he's getting knocked back by the COVID thing now, he still has been trending a little better than normal than your typical Republican candidate. How do you account for that?
You know, that is so, interestingly enough, and I'm so glad you asked that question. It's a two-part answer here. One, pre-COVID, President Trump has, in my opinion, and even now, I'll be honest, from a policy standpoint, has been the most impactful president for African Americans in my lifetime. From a policy standpoint, President Donald Trump has been the most impactful president from a policy standpoint. What do I mean by that? I'm talking about the First Step Act. Thousands of people released from jail, 90% of them being African American. Opportunity zones, 8,800 of those lifting, this is the White House Council made this reference, lifting about 1 million people out of poverty. We're talking specific African Americans, funding for historically black colleges. Now, going into recently, and this is why it was so troublesome, and I know we have people have disagreements in the conservative arena about President Donald Trump. And last week when they said, hey, will you condemn white supremacy? And he said, yes, I will. What do you want me to say? And then they talked about the Proud Boys and he said, stand down and stand by. That for a lot of people wasn't a real condemnation of white supremacy. And this isn't like, I don't know what the Proud Boys, I'm not as familiar with that group, so I really don't know. But what he could have said is, listen, I condemn all forms of hate, no matter where it comes from, what race, what culture, what group. And as a matter of fact, Joe Biden, what I've done is through my platinum plan to African Americans that I just introduced, I've designated the KKK as a domestic terrorist group, something that you nor President Obama has ever done. That's what he could have said, and that's what people wanted to hear him say, mm-hmm. because he's been an effective policymaker. So when you're talking about when you talk about African Americans and their support for this president, President Donald Trump, things have gone up because he has put his money where his mouth is. He said to African Americans in 2016, what do you have to lose? I'll turn it around and say, what do you have to gain? And I just mentioned the policy proposals. That's part of the reason why African American men have been trending so high on Donald Trump, because he's actually been doing something about the community. And, of course, Hispanics have felt that way similarly.
All right, we'll check it out. We'll see what happens with the debate tonight. The podcast, once again, folks, check it out where you get your podcast. Out Loud, one word, O-U-T-L-O-U-D, Out Loud with Giano Caldwell, G-I-A-N-N-O-C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L. He's a Fox News political analyst. Check him out. Giano, what's your Twitter handle again?
Yes, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Giano Caldwell, G-I-A-N-N-O, Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Giano, thank you, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, Giano. Be good. Take
care. Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right. Giano Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L. Let's get another preview of what is to happen tonight, our second one of the day. The first and only vice presidential debate takes place tonight in Utah. You know, these have been in vogue now since 1976, and there's usually only one vice presidential debate because the running theory is that as much as people want them to make a difference, they don't. But just for the sake of maybe discussion here, maybe this one will. You don't know because you've got two candidates here, an incumbent and a challenger, who are both, well, up there, especially the challenger, Joe Biden, who would be 78. When inaugurated to term number one, if he wins in a few weeks. Dr. Wesley Renfro is joining us from Quinnipiac University. He's an associate professor of political science. We've had him on the show before. Dr. Renfro, Paul here again. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm trying to soak all this in. Do you think that this will actually make a difference, or will this debate, no matter who wins, kind of just be another footnote in political history or not?
Yeah, I think it's much more likely to be a footnote than a paragraph. There's not a lot of evidence that suggests that debates of any kind matter in terms of the election, and it's especially less true for vice presidential debates. You know, I think even the nerdiest political junkies among us can probably only remember a couple good one-liners at most that have come out of vice presidential debates, and that's about it in the entire history of them. So, you know, I think it'll be interesting to watch tonight. We'll learn more about both of them as people and as politicians, but it's not gonna change the fundamentals of the election.
Yeah, in fact, I was thinking before I could remember two things, Dr. Renfro, and I both looked them up just to verify that my memory wasn't failing me. The one was the famous retort Lloyd Benson gave to Dan Quayle about knowing Jack Kennedy. And the other one I had forgotten about, I think that Bush number 41, George H.W. Bush, during his debate with Geraldine Ferraro, think he referred to her as Mrs. Ferraro or something like that.
Yeah, there was a big uproar over that. And then I believe that subsequent to that, that Barbara Bush in an interview, and I think she was, don't quote me on this because this is sort of back there, but I think that she referenced in an interview that exchange and said that she wanted to describe Geraldine Ferraro as a word that rhymed with witch.
So, yes, I remember that.
Now, there was also in 1992 Admiral Stockdale, if somebody remembers. He asked who he was on stage, and that wasn't.
And why am I here?
Yeah.
We all know Mike Pence. I mean, obviously, he's got a four-year track record, not just under President Trump, but the guy was, you know, in Congress before that for several years. He was kind of selected, I've always thought, as, you know, the kind of the poison pill here. Well, you want to get rid of Trump, you're going to have somebody that the base actually likes and is civil here. Kamala Harris, as a guy who carries a journalism degree, Dr. Renfro, I've been quite vocal on this show, as other people have. She hasn't done any news conferences. She has completely been steered away from anything but softball one-on-one interviews. This is going to be interesting because I think she, going back to her Democratic debate, she wasn't really good, I thought. So I think that's kind of a subtext here is if things get a little heated, if Mike Pence, who at one time, oddly enough, I don't know whether you knew this, he was a radio talk show host too. Yeah, whether he's going to try to kind of pin her on things like, you know, enlarging the Supreme Court and things like that.
So, you know, I think you're right. I would say that her debate performance was uneven, and she certainly had some very good deliveries of one-liners, but those were very scripted one-liners, so I think that's very consistent with a prosecutorial approach,
yeah.
right? I mean, these folks practice before they go into the courtroom. She's much less polished when she's speaking off the cuff or in response to things that she hasn't adequately prepared for. And so, you know, I am going to look to see how well she does in the debate. You know, I think that this will be heated. There will be a lot of serious talk. But I think that, you know, both of these people are, you know, reasonable and civil.
Yeah.
And there'll certainly be a lot more decorum than we saw in the first presidential debate. And I think the fact that Donald Trump is ill at the moment is going to nudge both of these folks to be on better behavior. You know, Joe Biden has stopped his personal attack ads, at least for the time being. And so I think it'll be civil, though serious and pointed.
Yeah, I would think that you're not going to see a Texas steel cage death match tonight like you saw a couple of weeks ago. And I think that probably Dr. Renfro is listen, none of these people tonight, neither of the vice president nor Senator Harris has to be, you know, this whole thing doesn't have to be impressed on them. I think they know that even if one of them doesn't do as well as the other, they will be, I'm guessing, kind of, geez, I don't know, congratulated for, you know, bringing back a little decorum to the whole process here.
Yeah, I agree. And certainly, at least based on public opinion polls right now, the ball is very much in the Biden-Harris court. And so, you know, Mike Pence probably faces, I think, a little bit of extra pressure to try and move the needle, although historically that has not happened. But I will say that, you know, Mike Pence, because, as you noted, he was a radio talk show host. He's a good debater, and he looks and sounds stereotypically presidential. And you know, that expression is fraught with all sorts of biases. But for a lot of people, when they, rightly or wrongly, imagine what a president pre-Donald Trump look and sounds like, it kind of matches with Mike Pence. And so I think that'll be interesting, not only on his end, but also Kamala Harris, who's a very different looking and sounding sort of person, you know, how folks process how she presents and what she says.
And I'm glad you said that, Dr. Renfro, because I've interviewed people over the years, and a friend of mine from years ago, his father did a lot of research on this at Yale, that the impressions, you know, we are human beings, and we look at, we listen to voices, we look at skin tone, we look at who's high, who's tall, who's short, who comes over as gracious and genteel. And you're right, Mike Pence, for his politics aside, he's right out of central casting. I mean, if I was casting a TV show, you know, if I was doing another you know, another run of 24 with Jack Bauer, I'd pick Pence to be the president in that.
Yeah, and you know, I think that it's true that at this point we're dealing with a pretty small undecided swath of the electorate. And for many of those people, rightly or wrongly, I think it is true that Mike Pence sort of looks like he comes from central casting. But top line, I'm very skeptical that anything that will happen tonight will matter in terms of moving the needle or changing the outcome.
Yeah, final question, Dr. Renfro, and I thank you for the time. Let me pick your brain on a couple of other things here that may come up tonight. We've had this kind of question hanging particularly over the Biden-Harris campaign. You know, will you be in favor of enlarging the Supreme Court, adding another two or four justices? As you know, FDR tried once. It's been done before. And or the elimination of the filibuster in the Senate, which may come up if the Democrats say win the White House. And let's say it's a landslide and they control both houses of Congress. What do you think the odds are for one or both of those happening?
You know, that's a prediction that I think is frankly beyond my skill. I will only say this. This is probably the most serious attempt at a structural reform of the Supreme Court since FDR tried.
Now,
it is also the case that FDR's motivation was in part a threat to the existing members of the court to stop rejecting parts of the New Deal. So there's some gamespersonship involved there. And that may be in part true here. I'm a little skeptical. You know, as a country, we have, I think to our detriment, stopped making structural changes to lots of things, including the Constitution. So I would be a little surprised if they did pull the trigger on this. That being said, you know, I think there's a lot of hurt feelings and a lot of bad blood over everything that happened after the nomination of Merrick Garland. So possible. I'm not quite sure that I think it's likely.
Well, thanks, Dr. Wesley Renfro, Associate Professor of Political Science, Quinnipiac University. Dr. Renfro, good to have you again, and we'll chat in the future. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.